KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
This land belongs to the people who live there, and he just wants to take it over.
A top Palestinian leader on President Trump's new goal of a U.S. takeover of the Gaza Strip and on what he wants to see next in Gaza. For Saturday, February 8th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we'll also examine Trump's attempt to take charge of the Kennedy Center. And we'll talk to Bill Gates about how, as a teenager, he saw the future of personal computing and he made it happen.
Even the big companies, particularly IBM, didn't see what we saw.
We'll preview tomorrow's Super Bowl with thorough analysis of the Eagles' signature play, the Tush Push, and we will consider birds.
The list is really a celebration of the beauty and diversity of bird sounds from around the world.
The best wild bird call recordings of the past year. Those stories and more, first this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Russell Vogt, an architect of Project 2025 and the new director of the Office of Management and Budget, is now also leading the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. NPR's Laurel Wamsley has more.
Senior executives at CFPB, the Federal Consumer Finance Watchdog, were informed Friday night that Vogt was taking the helm as acting director. He replaces Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who led the bureau for about a week. Meanwhile, members of Elon Musk's government efficiency team have gained access to computer systems at CFPB, including human resources, procurement, and finance. They now also control the Bureau's website and have deleted its social media accounts. The Bureau would on its face appear to be an unlikely target for cost-cutting, given its return on investment. CFPB's budget for 2025 is $823 million. Since its launch in 2011, the Bureau has returned more than $20 billion to consumers. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Palestinian militant group Hamas today released three Israeli hostages, part of that ceasefire deal struck last month, and Israel released more than 180 Palestinian prisoners and detainees in exchange. NPR's Jerome Sokolovsky has more.
Eliyahu Sharabi, Or Levy, and Ohad Ben-Ami looked thin and haggard. The men were led onto a stage where they gave statements to the crowd, flanked by heavily armed gunmen. Hamas took advantage of the handover to mount an elaborate ceremony, as in past hostage releases. Flags and banners celebrated Palestinian nationhood and condemned Israel. The mere fact that it went ahead is a signal that last month's ceasefire in Gaza is holding. Hamas has condemned a proposal by President Trump to relocate Palestinians out of Gaza to make way for post-war reconstruction. Jerome Sokolovsky, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
In Alaska, search crews are trying to retrieve the bodies of all 10 people on board the Bering airplane that was found crashed this week on an ice floe in the Bering Sea before expected high winds and snow set in. National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy.
We're in the initial stages, really focused first and foremost on the victims, which is what should be the focus right now.
The plane was traveling from Unalakleet to Nome Thursday when it disappeared. It was found the next day by the Coast Guard after an extensive search. There's no word on the cause. The National Institutes of Health is capping a certain kind of funding for medical research at universities, medical schools, research hospitals, and other scientific institutions. Because of the latest step in the Trump administration, that limits funding for indirect costs to 15% of grants, far below what institutions have been getting. The change applies to both current and future grants, alarming academics who say it puts their universities and medical centers in peril. The NIH spent more than $35 billion in fiscal year 2023. You're listening to NPR News. A powerful magnitude 7.6 earthquake hit the Caribbean today around 130 miles southwest of the Cayman Islands. That triggered a tsunami advisory for several islands nearby, but there are no alerts for the mainland U.S. The U.S. Geological Survey says it hit about halfway between the Cayman Islands and Honduras. Telehealth companies are selling cheaper versions of name-brand obesity drugs, but there could be problems. NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports.
Customers who bought obesity drugs online from a company called Zappy Health are confused after learning the pharmacy that filled their prescription didn't have the proper license to do so. The site offered compounded drugs, which aren't generics but are made by specialized pharmacies that are allowed to essentially make copies during drug shortages. But one of the pharmacies filling prescriptions for Zappy, Usha Pharmacy, didn't have a sterile compounding hunting license in Florida, where it was based. Scott Bruner is CEO of the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding.
I would not take a drug that it has been dispensed to that patient from a pharmacy that has been found to be in violation of its state license law.
In a statement online, Zappi says it has cut ties with OSHA. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
The National Weather Service says a strong storm system will bring moderate to heavy snowfall across parts of the upper Great Lakes and Northeast this weekend. Lead forecaster Bob Orovic.
One good thing with this storm, it is moving pretty quickly. So it's not going to be a prolonged winter weather event. It looks like the snow will definitely be coming to an end earlier in the day on Sunday, after which the weather will be fairly tranquil for a few days.
A second storm from the plains to the mid-Atlantic is forecast Tuesday. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. As another eventful week in Washington came to a close, key aspects of President Donald Trump's efforts to drastically reshape the U.S. government were put on hold by two federal courts. First, a U.S. district judge blocked an order to put thousands of USAID workers on leave. And then this morning, another federal judge blocked Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, from accessing sensitive Treasury Department records. With those efforts paused for now, President Trump moved to take over another federal institution. On Friday, he fired several board members at Washington, D.C.'s John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. And to the surprise of many in the arts world, Trump said he would name himself chairman. NPR's Bob Mondello is here in studio to help us make sense of what's happening. Hey, Bob.
Hey, good to be here.
So first of all, the Kennedy Center, it's home to the National Symphony, the Washington Opera. It's a place to see Broadway touring companies. But this is also a national monument.
Yes, a cultural center named for a president, situated in D.C. right at the edge of Rock Creek Park, which is maintained by the National Park Service. The center is a hybrid operation. The Park Service is responsible for keeping up the building, and Congress appropriates money for that. But what plays in the center is paid for by ticket revenue and private donations.
When it began, was there anything like it in Washington?
No. I'm a lifelong resident of D.C., so I'm allowed to say this. D.C. was a cultural backwater in 1955 when President Eisenhower first proposed building a National Performing Arts Auditorium, singular. The city only had one large concert venue. The center filled a void, and it also changed the country's arts focus. It brought the Bolshoi Ballet and the La Scala Opera to the U.S. for the first time. It inspired American artists, and President Kennedy talked about why that was important at a fundraiser for the center in 1962 when it was still sketches on a drawing board.
Today, as always, art knows no national boundaries. Genius can speak in any tongue, and the entire world will hear it and listen.
That's President Kennedy. Now let's talk about President Trump. Why does he say he's taking control?
Well, he didn't say this, but he has a history with the center. In his first term, he skipped the Kennedy Center honors when some of the honorees didn't want to meet him for a reception at the White House beforehand. He skipped all 4 years, the first president ever to do that. But on Truth Social, he just says that he's firing the board chairman, Carlyle Investment Group co-founder David Rubenstein, and other members who, quote, do not share our vision for a golden age in arts and culture. He didn't specify who else he fired, but the membership includes singer Jon Batiste and Grey's Anatomy creator Shonda Rhimes.
Any sense what this golden age is going to look like?
Well, it will apparently not include cross-dressing performers. His post on Truth Social claims that, and I'm quoting, just last year, the Kennedy Center featured drag shows specifically targeting our youth. This will stop. End quote. Now, I looked back through last year's bookings, and there were a couple of drag brunches in the center's restaurant, a lip-synced drag salute to divas in its free Millennium stage, and comedian Chris Anderson's silly solo show, Dixie's Tupperware Party.
And I get it. I'm lucky. Not everybody can be like me to have both beauty and the other one. So I'm just really lucky to be able to be. And that's why I want to share.
Did Trump say how this was so-called targeting youth?
No, I think that's a mix-up, actually. Dixie's Tupperware Party played at the Kennedy Center's smallest auditorium, which is called the Family Theater, because it only has 324 seats, and that makes it sound family-friendly compared to the 2,000-seat opera house and concert hall. But it is just a name. I've caught lectures and films at the Family Theater, just as I've seen concerts and plays at the opera house.
That is NPR's Bob Mondello. Bob, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Even judging by the standards that he set during his time on the national stage, President Donald Trump's statement this past week that the U.S. would take ownership of the Gaza Strip was shocking. During a press conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Trump said the two leaders had talked about relocating some 1.8 million Palestinians and leveling, then totally rebuilding, Gaza.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it.
The announcement drew condemnation from leaders around the world, and some senior Trump aides have tried to walk back aspects of the plan. But should the plan or something like it go forward, Gaza would change, as would its relationship with the other Palestinian territory, the West Bank. For one perspective on this, we have called Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who's a political leader in the West Bank. He's the general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative and a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council. He joins us now from Ramallah in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You, along with others, you publicly condemned President Trump's proposal. I'm curious, how are you and your colleagues in West Bank leadership talking about this this week? What are you thinking about?
Well, as I said in several interviews, President Trump's proposal is not just destructive to the possibility of peace in this region, but it is actually also criminal.
How so?
Because what he called for are two war crimes. The first crime is that he called for ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people who live in Gaza, who are part of the Palestinian people in general. And second, he called for the theft of the land of Gaza Strip and to take it over. This land belongs to the people who live there. Belongs to the people who lived there for thousands of years and who have their dreams, their history, their civilization, their belongings, and they just want to take it over.
As is often the case when President Trump makes a statement like this, there was a lot of analysis that perhaps he didn't actually mean that, but perhaps he was trying to set the framework for negotiations to lead to some sort of outcome. You, as somebody very close to this issue, I'm wondering what you make of that analysis and that thinking, and just kind of, again, what the conversations you've had with other leaders are about what comes next now that this proposal is out there.
We're talking about the President of the United States. I don't think He jokes when he speaks, and we're talking about the most powerful country in the world. To be advocate of violation of international law in such a manner is really shameful.
What to you is the best alternative? What to you is the best path forward in Gaza? Because there's no question there has been widespread destruction in Gaza. So much has been leveled, destroyed. So many people have died. How would you rebuild?
In my opinion, the alternative is, first of all, to make sure that the ceasefire should continue, that Israel would not be allowed to go back to war, and then there has to be an international Arab-Muslim coalition that would provide support to the people of Gaza to reconstruct and rebuild Gaza and initiate a true peace approach solution that allows Palestinians to be free from this terrible occupation so that everybody can enjoy security, whether we are talking about Palestinians or Israelis.
At this moment in time, who is in charge of Gaza? Who do you think should have the responsibility to rebuild, to plan for its future? Because if you look at public support in the Gaza Strip, it seems like many people there would like Hamas to remain in charge.
I know, but Hamas told us frankly and openly and clearly in our meetings of all Palestinian groups, which took place in Beijing, that they are ready to not to be in the government of Gaza and not to be the government of Gaza. And the solution is simple. I personally drafted it in agreement with all the representatives of the 14 parties, which is to create a national consensus Palestinian government, which consists mainly of independent professionals who will be accepted by everybody and will be cooperated with by everybody. But it will be a government for both West Bank and Gaza, so that nobody would separate Gaza from the West Bank and continue to kill the idea of a Palestinian independent state. So a national consensus government that would eventually prepare for free democratic elections, which we didn't have since 20 years. And I assure you, if we have elections, we're using proportional system. So if we have elections, no single party will have majority. That's for sure. All polls show that. So in my opinion, this is the solution. A national consensus government. And nobody wants to continue this war. Nobody wants to go back to war. And this government can be responsible in cooperation with the Arab governments and hopefully with many people in the international community of reconstructing Gaza and rebuilding it. And then, in my opinion, the whole world must exercise pressure on Israel to end occupation. This is the road, the path that was never tried. Ending occupation and allowing Palestinians to be free from occupation and build our own future independently with freedom.
If you could speak directly to President Trump right now, what would you say to him?
I would say to him, if you want to get Nobel Peace Prize, the road is simple. Pressure Israel to end occupation, allow Palestinians to be free. You are most welcome to bring international troops if you want and put them on the borders between the Palestinian state and Israel to provide security for everybody, then you can get Nobel Peace Prize. But if you proceed to advocate ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people of Gaza and continue to be totally biased to Israel in the way and manner you are, you will be described in history as a war criminal, not as a Nobel Peace Prize winner. I will be frank with him. I think he likes people to be honest and frank with him. Mm-hmm. It's either peace by ending Israeli occupation and allowing Palestinians to have self-determination and freedom, or it's war crime. That is the reality of what we see today.
It's Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative and a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
For updates and a range of perspectives on the war in Gaza, visit npr.org/Mideast Updates. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. A federal judge blocked Elon Musk's government efficiency team from getting access to Treasury Department systems used to process trillions of dollars in payments. It also contains the personal and financial information of millions of Americans. Russell Vogt, an architect of the ultra-conservative Project 2025 and the new director of the powerful Office of Management and Budget, is now also leading the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Since its launch in 2011, the CFPB has has returned more than $20 billion to consumers. And the Super Bowl takes place tomorrow in New Orleans as the Philadelphia Eagles take on the Kansas City Chiefs, who are seeking their third Super Bowl win in a row. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Bill Gates has written a lot of books, but they've all stuck to a few similar themes. They've mostly been about the future, technological changes coming in society, things like that. And true to his reputation in the world of computing and global health, they've all been pretty wonky. His new book is different.
So as only as I was turning 70 this year, Microsoft turning 50, that I decided, okay, maybe it is time to look back a little bit.
It's a memoir called Source Code that takes Gates' story from birth to the moment he realized this company he'd started with some friends, a company called Microsoft, wasn't just something to work on in between his college classes at Harvard. It describes in detail the adolescence and early adult life of one of America's most successful and influential entrepreneurs. How Gates snuck out in the middle of the night to code at the computer lab, his middle and high school friendship with Paul Allen that led to Microsoft, and the mindset they shared about computers and a brand new industry that led the two of them and their friends to outmaneuver big established business giants like IBM. Something else that Gates grapples with in the book is that the kind of kid who could do all of that was also a kid who could be really difficult for parents and teachers to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, I blush thinking of how I could be abrasive or, you know, things like where I told my professor when he was wrong and turned out I was completely wrong. You know, I wanted to get that off my chest because I've always felt bad about it. And yeah. he was very gracious when I spoke to him recently.
The thing that I was thinking about reading this is I'm wondering what you think about the idea, like how much of this path to success is replicable in 2025? Because on one hand, you have this industry being created around you in the moment. You're in the right place at the right time. The industry is exponentially expanding. But on the other hand, there's like this level of freedom that a teenager can have to go sneak out your window and code at 2 a.m. and then to ride the bus to another city and code sensitive infrastructure. Like it feels like a Ferris Bueller movie type thing where just like clearly no teen would be able to do that today. Like, is any of this replicable these days?
There's no doubt that kids are more subject to restrictions. Even the hiking that I did where my parents didn't know where we were, it's not how I raised children. We were a lot tighter. And there is some pushback on that because you don't mature in quite the same way. You don't get to make the same mistakes. Mm-hmm. You know, I still think there will be unbelievable entrepreneurs, but I was lucky that Paul Allen and I saw personal computing and the role of software, and almost nobody else did. Even the big companies, particularly IBM, didn't see what we saw. So you always, when you have lots of companies, you have to find a flaw in their thinking.
Yeah.
And so it'd be tougher today.
I want to back up a little bit in the story that you tell in this book and ask you to tell us about your best friend from high school, Kent Evans.
So when they computer shows up, there's really four of us who a few months later are still there obsessed. And my best friend by far, Kent Evans, who I talk to every night, he was a great student, more diligent than I was. He influenced me. He was more outward looking, really amazing person.
He was like showing up to school in a briefcase.
Yeah, he had all these magazines, very serious. He followed the politics of the time when I wasn't doing that. And so he and I had always thought, okay, we're going to go off and pursue some computer-related dream. And so it's when I'm a junior in high school, I'm 16, he's 17, that this mountain climbing course, that it was surprising he chose to sign up for, because he was even less naturally coordinated than I was. And tragically, you know, I talked to him Friday night. He goes off, falls down the mountain over the weekend, and the headmaster calls me that Sunday and says that Kent isn't just hurt. He's died. And that was such a shock to me. You know, my childhood was really idyllic in a lot of ways. It's the only traumatic thing, and, you know, pretty hard to process, because, you know, I would have, you know, partnered with him in some way. I reach out at that time to Paul, and he comes back and helps me out. And that sort of gets us spending lots of time together.
Yeah.
That leads to us founding Microsoft.
Given that, how much time have you spent thinking about how different your life is if he doesn't die? Because you write in the book, and you said here that you would have kept working him in one way or another for sure. But at the same time, that's the event that causes you to really dig in with Paul working on these programs that become the business.
You know, when I saw Kent's father not long ago, we talked about that, you know, we probably, because we were so close, would have gone to the same school. You know, Kent and I were the most action-oriented of that foursome. He would have been great at helping get the business going, since Paul's conceptual thinking was super necessary, but he counted on me for the more mundane parts of doing things. So it would have been different with Kent, but, you know, we would have had a partnership and done our best.
Do you remember the moment when you and the other kids at the computer lab realized, like, okay, in the next 20 years, everyone's going to have a computer? Like, do you remember when that clicked into place? Like, this is going to happen?
Yeah, when I helped Paul get a job in Boston and he moved out my sophomore year, we were already writing that there'd be a computer on every desk and in every home. And that became sort of the founding slogan of Microsoft. Actually, we added the words running Microsoft software, which was kind of the self-centered piece. And I was going to professors and saying, look, computing is going to become free because of this exponential improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, let's get involved in thinking that through. And people just didn't see it. That kind of surprised us, but it's what gave us the edge. You know, Paul wanted to do personal computers. I said, no, let's just do the software piece. And then when the first kit computer comes out, that's when I know to be on the ground floor of the revolution we'd been waiting for, that I had to drop out.
Why do you think it was a bunch of kids who saw that so clearly, and professors and big companies and all of the existing infrastructure didn't quite see it the same way that you did?
Well, once you get your mindset that computers are these rare, expensive things, and you've been spending your time thinking about how you make them a little more efficient and a little less expensive, when somebody who's young and hasn't been around can say, wait a minute, exponential improvement. You know, that's the chip industry off in California, Intel.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer industry, both IBM and the mini computer companies that are mostly up in the Boston area, they're not really tracking that. I mean, Paul and I, the minute the 8080 chip was announced in 1973, Paul says to me, is this one good enough? And I say, Paul, this thing is better than the most popular mini computer, which was a $20,000 machine. And so we were like, wow, how come everybody's not, their mind isn't blown?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we show up and actually call the company with that kit computer, you know, they were amazed.
Bill Gates, among many other titles, author of the new book Source Code. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, the U.S. and much of Europe are slowly adapting to electric vehicles. 9 out of every 10 cars sold in Norway are electric. The Scandinavian country is seen as an EV paradise. NPR's Rob Schmitz went there to give Norway's EV infrastructure a test drive.
Okay, so I have just got into the driver's seat of my Volkswagen ID3 here at the rental car agency in Oslo.
For those of us brought up on combustion engines, the battery range is the biggest worry when you switch to electric. You find yourself thinking, where am I going to charge this car?
Looks like the battery has 415 kilometers of range right now, 89% charged. I'm going only about 90 kilometers, so that should be okay. Let's see how this works.
In fact, there are chargers all over Norway, thanks in part to the efforts of Sturri Portvik, manager for electromobility for the city of Oslo, who's been putting up chargers since 2007, when the city committed to an electric vehicle future.
To be honest, it's challenging, but sometimes I feel a little bit like I'm running after the train and the train is leaving the platform.
Ensuring there are enough electric vehicle chargers spread out along the country's 60,000 miles of winding roads that carve into the fjords and mountains of Norway has been top of mind for years, says Portvik. And it might seem strange that Norway, a country whose biggest export is oil and which has no domestic automaker to speak of, would champion the electric car. But Portvik says that's precisely why Norway has gone this route.
So it was easier to make the more polluting cars more expensive and remove totally the tax on zero emission vehicles.
Most things Norwegians buy incur a value added tax that equals 25% of the value of each product. Since 2001, Norway's government lifted this tax from all electric vehicle purchases, which meant anyone buying an EV could save tens of thousands of dollars. The government also cut road taxes, ferry prices, and parking fees for EV owners by half. Truls Golofsen, head of Friends of the Earth in Norway, says these incentives worked. New car buyers bought EVs, and suddenly the global EV industry was looking to Norway.
The Norwegian test market proved that electric vehicles could work and allowed the car brands to test and learn, both from charging and from user experience. And the population and government was sort of generally very supportive, also because this came into sort of as a climate change solution that didn't really need to challenge the oil industry, consumer behavior, or anything else.
And in some ways, says Golofsen, Norway's been a victim of its own success. The government recently had to reinstate value-added taxes on sales of luxury electric cars that cost more than $47,000 due to a boom in sales of electric Porsche Taycans and Tesla Xs. And while Norway has tweaked its policies to adjust to this new market, the market has tweaked its services as well. At a Circle K gas station outside of Oslo, Hakon Stixrud gives me a tour.
We have car wash here, we have truck fueling, we have fuel, we have EV charging. It's actually the first EV charging site of Circle K history. I had the first charger in 2011.
From 2011 to 2017, this station had a single charger. But then EVs with longer ranges hit the market, and the station built several more chargers to keep up with demand. Now, says Stixrud, Circle K has 700 chargers at more than 200 stations inside of Norway. And he says this has changed how Circle K designs its stations.
When the EV drivers come and charge, they do it also for a break. And what we see is that they convert more often to the store than the fuel customer. They buy a higher basket and they buy a higher margin product such as food.
Circle K's stations with chargers have a seating area with booths for longer waits. They've got Wi-Fi and more outlets for charging laptops. Despite this, taxi driver Gulfam Raja decides to stay in his car while it's charging. While he waits, he complains about Oslo's new rule that all taxis are required to be electric.
In the wintertime, I think I have to charge two times a day between my 10-hour shift. And every time when I'm going to charge, it will take me between 30 minutes to 1 hour. And if I lost 2 hours of my working time, it's some money, you know.
Raja says he wishes he had a gas-powered car, not only because it takes him only 3 minutes to refuel, but...
When you fill your tank, if the car says that you can drive 500 kilometers with a diesel car, it will give you 550 or 600. But when the electric car shows you that it will give you 500, but in reality, it will give you like 250, maybe 200, 250 in the wintertime.
Oslo electromobility guru Sturri Portvik says he has heard complaints like this before, but he says taxi drivers like Raja should focus on changing their behavior. Yeah, it's going to hurt a little bit, he says, but we all have to do it. And he says Norway's next goal is not focused on EVs at all. It's about getting more and more people on public transportation and persuading Norwegians to walk and bike more. returning transport to its carbon-free basics. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Oslo.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It is almost here. The Kansas City Chiefs meet the Philadelphia Eagles tomorrow for a date with history. The Chiefs are trying to become the first NFL team ever to win three Super Bowls in a row. Here to preview the game for us is NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan. Hey, Becky.
Hey there, Scott.
You know, I'm going to start being a contrarian. How big of a deal is this game really, given that the Chiefs have spent a lot of time in the Super Bowl and the Eagles were also just in it a few years ago?
Look, I can understand somebody feeling that way. I felt a lot of fatigue myself when the New England Patriots were doing this all the time. Mm-hmm. But as a football fan, I can't overstate, I think this is a very big deal. Even if you are tired of the Chiefs, or even if you don't like have any love for Philly, because these are two very good football teams, all signs pointing to a close game that'll be fun to watch no matter what. And then obviously, I think the three-peat is noteworthy. Yeah. A lot of teams we think of as NFL dynasties, like the all-time great teams, didn't do this. The Pittsburgh Steelers of the 70s, the Dallas Cowboys of the 90s, the New England Patriots with Tom Brady, none of them have this feather in their cap. And I think really it's like, because of that, it's the ultimate feather for like sort of NFL greatness.
And it's not just that too. Like, I feel like we're like roughly the same age. And I feel like we came of age as sports fans in this era of three-peats being this big thing. The Bulls, the Lakers, a team I know you love, the New York Yankees, all three-peating. But it actually hasn't happened at all since then. It's been like, it's been a quarter century.
Yeah. And I think for the Chiefs, it comes down to the fact that we are watching two of the greatest to ever do it, not only in football, maybe of any sport, in head coach Andy Reid and their quarterback Patrick Mahomes.
Let's talk about the Eagles for a minute and their biggest star of the season, one of the breakout stars of the league as a whole, Saquon Barkley.
He came to the Eagles this past offseason after he was let go by the New York Giants. He was good with the Giants and they let him walk. Now he has joined the Eagles, which are a better team altogether, and he has been amazing. He's had one of the best seasons for a running back ever. Highlight after highlight in the regular season and in the playoffs. He is a threat at any moment to break loose for a long touchdown. And the Chiefs all this past week in New Orleans have been talking about just what a challenge he is. And so here is Chiefs defensive lineman Chris Jones talking about Saquon.
He can jump cut, he can outrun you, he can run you over. He got so many schematics to his game. It's just not no one thing he does. He's so athletic.
Obviously, that's a lot of compliments for one guy. And the reason is because he forces teams into a tough choice. You know, do you stack defenders up at the line of scrimmage? Do you sell out to try to stop him short? But then maybe you're opening yourself up to pass plays by having it kind of an emptier backfield. Or what if Saquon gets through that first level and then he runs free for a touchdown? That's a really hard choice for a team to make, and he's been making teams do it all season long, and that's why the Eagles are here.
Yeah. We need to talk about something else that has to do with the Eagles. We need to talk about the tush push.
Yes. This is a play that the Eagles really have become known for. They've been running it for a few years now, and it's their take on a play that, you know, you might normally call the quarterback sneak. Essentially, the quarterback is standing right behind the center. He takes the snap, and then he immediately jumps slash sort of pushes forward as far as he can into what ends up being this, like, massive pile of football bodies. Mm-hmm. And you only see it in a situation in which you need, like, a yard, maybe 2 yards, but that happens several times a game, often like in key moments, like on a third down or right on the goal line, you're about to score a touchdown. And the Eagles have turned this play into an art. They're successful upwards of like 80 or 90% of the time. That is way higher than other teams. And so for the Chiefs, you know, I talked to defensive coaches, defensive players, and they said, really, they're not sure that they can stop it at all. And so the best defense for them is going to be to try to just not let the Eagles get into that short yardage situation at all, which I'll tell them good luck with that.
That's NPR's Becky Sullivan. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
This is NPR News.
Searching for her next project, filmmaker Dawn Porter met with some record execs.
They mentioned Luther, and I was like, stop. There's no Luther Vandross documentary? What are you saying out loud?
Well, now there is. Luther Never Too Much, and we're going to play some Luther Vandross Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. I just don't.
never too much, never too much.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The Palestinian militant group Hamas released three more hostages today, and Israel, in return, released more than 180 Palestinian prisoners and detainees, all part of the six-week ceasefire agreement. Hamas is still holding some 76 civilians and soldiers. Recovery efforts are underway in western Alaska after a commuter plane with 10 people on board crashed this week, going down in the Bering Sea on a flight to Nome. There were no survivors, and there's no word on a cause. And a more than 300-year-old Stradivarius violin was sold at auction in New York for more than $11 million. It was sold by the New England Conservatory in Boston, which will use the proceeds to fund student scholarships. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm. On the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO Rene Haas talks to Christopher Miller, author of Chip War, about how tech is helping to shape the future of computing. Available on all podcast platforms. From the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. There is something wrong with the plumbing in Cincinnati. Billions of gallons of raw sewage end up in the waterways each year. And for some people in the city, that raw sewage gets a lot closer to home, like inside their actual homes. From Cincinnati Public Radio comes the podcast Backed Up. Host Becca Costello, producer Ella Rowan, dive deep into one of the most complex parts of our infrastructure.
We're talking about the sewers. For most of us, once we flush the toilet, it's someone else's problem.
That is, until whatever you flushed comes back up.
This is the first big mystery. Sewage ends up in places it doesn't belong way more than it should, in Cincinnati and lots of other cities. So why?
Should we bring in the bulletin board?
Let's do it.
All right, so if movies and TV have taught me anything about mystery solving, it's that we need to put all of our evidence on a bulletin board.
Imagine a dark, windowless room. A cluttered table sits beneath a flickering bare light bulb. Ella is pouring herself a 10th cup of coffee while I pin newspaper clippings and suspect photos to the bulletin board.
We connect the dots with red yarn, trying to decode dozens of sewer-related acronyms.
EPA.
CSO. MSD.
CCF.
MSD. EPA is BOMA.
MSD.
CSO.
Yes.
MSD.
Okay, so here's what we know. I'm putting up a map of Cincinnati, right on the Ohio River. That's where we live.
So the sewer system is run by the Metropolitan Sewer District of Greater Cincinnati. And going forward, we're just going to say MSD instead of all of that. MSD also covers most of Hamilton County.
MSD is a wastewater utility. They collect dirty sewage, like what goes down the toilet, industrial waste, like what comes from factories, and a lot of stormwater. That comes from clouds.
They treat it, then release it, squeaky clean, back into waterways like the Mill Creek and the Ohio River. Here's how they describe their work.
The Metropolitan Sewer District of Greater Cincinnati maintains more than 3,000 miles of public sewer. On a typical dry weather day, wastewater from our homes, businesses, and schools flows through the public sewer without problem to one of MSD's seven major wastewater treatment plants. But what happens when it rains?
When it rains, the system can't handle the sudden influx of stormwater.
When it rains harder, even more stormwater can enter the sewers, which can cause the system to become overwhelmed with more flow than it can carry.
Overwhelmed with more flow than it can carry. That means when it rains a lot, all at once, untreated sewage gets backed up.
Hey, that's the name of the show.
through pipes into people's basements. This is called a sewer backup, or SBU.
Sewer backups.
Right.
Okay, so let's start there. That seems like kind of an urgent problem.
Hi, friends. I'm Becca. This is Ella.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Florence Miller has lived in Cincinnati her whole life. This house, right on the edge of Clifton and North Avondale, was built in 1922, and she's lived here for over 50 years, right now with one of her sisters.
Been retired since 2016, and before that, I was a programmer analyst, you know, from like 1968, and I have two sisters and a brother, and I'm the oldest of the four. I've traveled pretty much as a world. I've been to 25 countries.
Oh, wow.
Ridden on the Trans-Siberian Railroad and walked the Great Wall of China. Been to the Galapagos Islands, Iceland. So, yeah, I've been fortunate to be able to do that.
But you've always stayed in Cincinnati as your home base. So why is that? What do you love about Cincinnati that kept you here?
It was family. You know, we're all here within 10 miles of one another. So
it's really the best definition of home, right?
Right. Yeah. Like, The Wizard of Oz, there's no place like home, right?
It's a twister! It's a twister!
Actually, it was a thunderstorm on a rainy August night in 2016.
It was a Sunday night. I think it was a Sunday night.
Torrents of rain falling from the sky, collecting on concrete and asphalt, creating the perfect flash flood storm.
Florence had just retired. She was sitting at home watching what she thought was a typical Midwest storm roll in. But when she went down the basement stairs to check on her cat, Gabriel, she realized this storm was different. Did you know that it was sewage?
Oh yeah, when it's coming out of the drain down there, it's sewage.
Did it smell?
Oh yeah, the stench was terrible.
Dirty water was gushing up through the floor drains, and it was rising fast.
I mean, it was up to our waist when we were wading through, and it's like if we would have fallen down, we would have drowned. I'd never seen anything like that in my life. Yeah. But I'm in my late 70s, so.
Florence showed us piles of pictures she'd saved from the day of the storm.
We have a whole bunch, but this is the one that was on the newspaper. That's my car.
Oh my God. That photo was wild. The water nearly covered the hood of her car.
The headline, by the way, above this.
Oh, storm of the century, right. Because here's the backyard. That's the backyard.
It's just a pond.
Yeah. And I'm just glad Gabriel wasn't down in the basement at the time. Because he would have died.
Gabriel the cat was thankfully not in the basement that night. But Florence stored lots of meaningful things down there, like family keepsakes.
We lost my great aunt's credenza down there. We lost that, and we lost my mother's wicker needlepoint basket. And we lost some personal Christmas ornaments, you know, because everything was just toppled over.
The list of damages was long.
Oh, yeah, this was the dryer.
Was that ruined?
Oh yeah, the dryer and the washer and the water heater, the furnace, the air conditioner, the dehumidifier. Yeah, there's a gazillion pictures.
Oh wow, it almost looks like a tornado, like tornado damage.
But then too, the gas was leaking, you know, from the furnace. Everything was destroyed.
Were you aware of issues with the sewer system or anything before this happened to you?
No, I mean, that would be the farthest thing from anybody's mind, really. Yeah.
Florence said the water went down within a couple of hours, but the damage stayed behind.
The morning after the storm, she actually saw a couple of MSD workers down the street.
And I thought, they're coming over here, and they're going to see this, and they're going to say it's, you know, sewage backup, and they're going to give me a work order.
She marched over there and just stood waiting for them to finish and then demanded an inspection. And it worked. They came over and took responsibility.
It was draining to do this, you know, because we were trying to clean out everything, plus, you know, itemize everything and then put it in a spreadsheet that you could submit to them. I mean, it took months.
When MSD causes a sewer backup, they're supposed to cover the cleaning costs.
You know, then I submitted the claim for the cleaning because it was mold and mildew mediation, and then the fans to dry everything up. Oh, then MSD wasn't paying him. And then he came over one Saturday and said, I'm going to put a lien on your property. I said, oh, no, you're not. You know, it's like, that's not my problem. You need to deal with MSD.
So when you first submitted your itemized claim, what was the total amount that you ended up with that you would need
to pay? It was $22,000 a month. That was quite a lump sum of money, you know, and like people couldn't afford to finance that kind of thing either. Fortunately, I could, you know, but it took over a year to pay everything off.
I just keep picturing Florence wading through all of that water in her basement looking for her cat. And it, oh, I hate it.
Right, and think about what raw sewage actually means. We're talking bacteria, other hazardous substances that can be pretty dangerous to come into contact with.
And like, she didn't swallow any of the water, but imagine if she had. She easily could have tripped and fallen.
And Florence wasn't the only one with a flooded basement that night. The 2016 storm ended up being one of the worst in decades. There were sewer backups and flooding all over the city.
MSD has reimbursed Florence for the money she spent. That was host Becca Costello and producer Ella Rowan for Cincinnati Public Radio's podcast, Backed Up. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. And finally today, a little bit of nature to ease you into your evening. That chirping you're hearing right now is the Western Meadowlark. It's one of the sounds that made the Macaulay Library's list of best audio recordings of 2025. The library is an online collection featuring more than 2 million recordings of birds and other animals. It's put together by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Matthew Medler is an associate editor of All About Birds. That is a guide that is put together by the Cornell Lab and joins us now to guide us through all of these sounds. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this list. Tell us about this library as a whole and why it's so important to you to collect all these sounds.
Yeah, so the list is really a celebration of the beauty and diversity of bird sounds from around the world. And the Macaulay Library Archive at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology is the premier scientific archive of bird sounds. So it now houses over 2.5 million recordings from every continent on Earth. And this can be used as a resource for scientists who want to investigate details of bird sound, bird taxonomy, and really any question that they can think of related to bird sounds. At the same time, it also serves as an educational resource for people that are interested in learning more about the birds, you know, near their homes or where they like to go bird watching.
So this audio is coming in from experts, from amateur volunteers, from all sorts of sources, and this is the best of the best of the sounds collected in the last year?
Correct. Yeah, so anybody with an internet connection can contribute their recordings to the Macaulay Library, and the way to do that is through the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's eBird app, which is an app that you can download for free, and then you submit your bird observations, and then once you've said what birds you've seen on a given outing, then you can just drag and drop your recordings onto your checklist, and the recordings go into eBird and the Macaulay Library.
Let's listen to a few of them and talk about them.
Sounds great.
So this was in the Capturing Natural Moments category. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, this is a really special recording. This is a young banded wren. So it's kind of like a recording of a young child that's just learning how to talk. Mm-hmm. So this is not what an adult banded wren sounds like at all. We have another recording that perhaps we can listen to the adult example as well, just as a comparison.
Okay. Oh, that's so different.
Yeah, like if you didn't know that they were the same species, you'd have no idea that that was the same bird, yeah. Or the same species, I should say. So the recordist in this case, Roseli Juarez, she knows this bird very well, and she realized when she was out in the field that she was hearing something special. She was hearing this young bird, because even though there are, you know, billions of baby birds born every year, it's pretty rare to actually hear them singing in the wild, and it's even rarer to make such a nice recording. You know, the adult is really crisp. It has this short, discreet song, these really rapid, you know, trills. And the young bird just kind of sounds a little bit like a jazz musician, kind of just, you know, rambling along, kind of no clear riffs at all, just kind of improvising.
Let's go to another bird that is one of my physical favorite birds to look at. I just think they're so interesting looking. Sandhill crane. So let's take a listen. What category did you put that sandhill crane in, and why?
We put this into the beautiful sounds category. It just gives me goosebumps when I hear that sound. As you said, it's a beautiful bird. It's this big, elegant, you know, graceful bird. And they do these bugling sounds that can be heard for over 2 miles away. So, you know, sometimes when you're in the field, you'll hear that sound well before you actually see the bird. And it just, yeah, it just kind of makes the hair stand on end when you hear it. It's just this incredible loud bugle.
Yeah. I mentioned before the virtuosic singer category. Let's listen to one from that category. This is the New Zealand bellbird. I mean, such range.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's just that going from, you know, high to low just in a split second, and just kind of that beautiful kind of tinkling sound, the tinkling quality to the notes. It's only found in New Zealand, and it's one of the more common native birds there. So when you're in the forest, sometimes these several birds will vocalize all at the same time. And if you're in the forest, you can almost be surrounded by these beautiful notes. And it's just this magical experience.
Yeah. And then that one note just like blasts at like a different level than all the other ones.
Exactly.
Wondering if you have any tips for somebody who is maybe already trying or wants to try recording some of these bird calls, that, you know, maybe doesn't want to spend a ton on high level recording equipment, but what are some tips and tricks to get that good sound, to capture it well?
So there are three things that really pay off no matter what sort of gear you have, you know, starting, if you want to start with a smartphone. One is, you know, learning to be quiet. So don't make any sounds moving, you know, walking on leaves or on a gravel path. That sort of thing makes sound that we might not be aware of until we start to do sound recording. The next thing is really kind of understanding the behavior of the birds or mammals that you're trying to record. So don't just rush after a bird, because if you do that, you're probably going to scare it away. So it's better to just kind of quiet down, observe the bird a little bit, get a feel for where the bird is singing from, how it's moving around a territory, and then picking a spot where you think that you can make a recording but not disturb the bird from its natural behavior. And then another thing is just having patience. Sometimes the birds, you know, they take a little time in between songs, or they might fly away to a different perch and then come back. So being patient, and then finally being persistent.
That's Matthew Medler, associate editor of the All About Birds Guide at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Some on our staff would want me to follow up that segment about birds with a Go Birds. For Saturday, that is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. We will be back tomorrow and hope you'll join us. Until then, have a great night.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.